This is the Cornell West Show. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are delighted that Dr. West is with us. Other days
we've
called...
consented to let us be here.
The rest of it, of course, is conversations with people at the leading edge. And most assuredly, Dr. Cornell West is there. I have recently been helped to see that optimism and hope are quite different. So as you talk about tragicomic hope, this is a very serious and beautiful subject, isn't it?
Absolutely. Because hope is something that is earned by means of blood, sweat, and tears, which means it's participatory and is usually against the grain. Optimism tends to be a spectatorial conclusion. You can look at the evidence and see whether things are getting better or not and so forth. So that when you talk about hope, you're already in the muck, or what the great Sam Beckett calls the mess. And he's, of course, tragicomic, too.
Yes.
Oh, yes. And the mess surrounds you, you know what I mean? So it's not a matter of getting a perspective. It's a matter of trying to cope and get through, navigate, negotiate through all the mess that you're in. And I think the blues, of course, always presupposes funk, you know, the funk of America, the funk of life, the night side, the underside. And then you attempt to transfigure that funk into something sweet. You see, it's like from chitlins into a delicacy, social misery into linguistic virtuosity, minor keys into sustaining a people.
And you say, quite unequivocally, that America is not going to find its way out of a very troubled time without the beauty and the energy that comes from the African-American experience that has had to deal in the muck.
Absolutely.
I don't think that would spring to mind for mainstream America.
No, I think most mainstream American brothers and sisters would have to acknowledge that, for example, 9/11, most Americans feel unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hate it. Well, to be a nigger in America for 350 years, it'd be unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hate it. Now, the question becomes, what are the dominant responses? You see, when Emmett Till's mother looked at her baby and saw his head five times the size of his ordinary head, and had to say to the world, what is your response to American terrorism? She said, I don't have a minute to hate. I'll pursue justice for the rest of my life. Well, that to me is an instance of spiritual strength and moral maturity. Martin King had to do the same thing, dealing with the victims of American terrorism, with the four precious kids in Birmingham. What are you going to say, Martin? Tears coming down his eyes, right? This is not Socratic's noble self-mastery. This is bringing together the questioning and the witness and the hope. He says what? We've got to muster the courage to exercise the armor of love and justice. Well, how will America respond to its niggerization? Will they meet the standards of Brother Martin's, Sister Emmett Till's mother? Or will it be not justice but revenge? Will it be Lone Ranger strategies? Will it be cowboy mentalities? Will it be demonizing the other? Would it be Ahab-like in the greatest novel ever written by an American 32-year-old Herman Melville, dominate, conquer, machismo identity that flies in the face of the best of the way in which black people dealt with terrorism and negrization? So the question becomes, not as a nation as the blues, can that blues nation learn from a blues people? That's the question. I think it's a fundamental question.
You go straight. I want to get back to the Enlightenment, because America comes out of that tradition self-consciously in many ways. But you tend to skip that first generation and go straight to Emerson
and to
Melville.
Right.
And it seems that what you're doing, I'm going to go out on a limb, is there's a nice set of theories out here. Some of them,
you mean the Founding Fathers' theories?
Yeah, and I hold them in very high regard, and we're still enjoying the benefits of some of those.
Oh,
however,
absolutely.
There were some serious contradictions, intellectual contradictions within those theories, but more substantially was the muck piece of that. And my sense is that you see Emerson and Melville and the long line of successors as being real people dealing with reality and the mess that is living, but that also is functional democracy.
Well, and that muck, to be very explicit, was slavery from day one.
Mm-hmm. But I would include, you know, women's oppression and non-property holding white brothers and so forth. But the exemplary thing was both the monk and the situation of indigenous peoples. But it raises an important question. I mean, on the one hand, see, I think part of the genius of the Founding Fathers was that they incorporated Socratic dimension in the Bill of Rights and in the ability
to amend. The Socratic dimension being to
the questioning fallible claims, open to revision. Both the fact that the Constitution can be amended and the fact that you protect parhesia, you protect frank speech, plain speech in the Bill of Rights. You got, as part of the genius of the Founding Fathers, even as they turned away from the muck, because of that muck in part was a precondition for the democracy. You had to have indigenous people's lands and bodies subordinated and enslaved 22% of the inhabitants of the 13 colonies as slaves. So that's a precondition for the democracy. But they had enough vision to say, they've got to have this questioning built in, even though the dogmas that we are overlooking could lead toward our destruction. We saw that in the 1860s, when the dogma of white supremacy was so deep that we almost lost the democracy. So I do want to affirm the best of the Founding Fathers, but it's just, if you keep track of the Socratic energies of the Enlightenment, then I think you're going to find much of the best of the Enlightenment. But the Enlightenment oftentimes cast itself as if it had no darkness shot through its light. And that itself is dogmatic, where the Socratic energy gives you some perspective on even that which the Enlightenment is hiding and concealing.
You go back, this I think is germane. You talk about the built-in conflict with Plato, trying to represent Socrates. On the one hand, you have this open-ended questioning, right. And on the other hand, Plato just simply could not get past structure and a closed system. And that continues to this day, and it's the one thing that makes both Socrates and Plato continue to be relevant. And we're still fighting that same battle.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, Plato is he's in some ways a topos. He's unclassifiable because he hates dogma and he hates disorder at the same time.
That's tough.
So he creates the most democratic of genres, the Socratic Alingus, the question and answer, with all that rich contestation and suspicion of authority, which is the foundation of Western philosophy. And the great Whitehead used to say Western philosophy is a footnote, series of footnotes to Plato. That's what he meant. But then at the same time, Plato hates disorder. And Eric Voegelin and others speak about this with great wisdom. And therefore, he's got to have harmony, and he can't conceive of the soul or the polis being one of harmony while he allows for too much parhesia. And so you end up with this schizophrenia.
He doesn't trust the people.
You know, he doesn't trust the people, and he thinks that that people who are locked into opinion rather than knowledge and appearance rather than reality cannot but be unruly, cannot but be corrupted, and therefore it will result in a tyranny, because he hates tyranny too. He thinks tyranny itself creates disorder. And of course, his critique is a powerful one, because all democracies are subject to corruption. All we got to do is look at our own. You know, our American political system today is very much legalized bribery, normalized corruption. And the question is, how do you create some wiggle room within it? Well, see, Plato's critique still echoes down through the course of time to us. It's just that he's got an authoritarian response to it. Those of us coming out of Emerson and Dewey and Louis Armstrong and Muriel Rukeyser and others and King say, well, we actually believe that the cure for these corruptions in democracy is more democratic accountability.
That's a very big divide.
That's a very major divide.
In a way,
absolutely.
Listening to you, the answer to his dilemma...
His Plato's,
as you describe it, is jazz and blues. Because it is structured, but it is not structured. It is open-ended, but it is not unconstrained.
Absolutely. A deep sense of order, but also suspicious of dogma.
And,
that's a very powerful point, though.
And deeply individual.
Yes. Well, linked to community, but that individuality, finding your own voice, only you can find it. All imitation is suicide. All emulation is a sign of adolescent minds. You're absolutely right. And I take individuality very seriously, but I'm very suspicious of individualism, the ideology that views us as atomistic individuals, unrelated, disconnected to one another in any substantive ways.
Aren't you now talking about America right now?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Market-driven America, in which the atomistic individualism and hedonism and narcissism is becoming more and more pervasive, in which people are feeling empty, wrestling with spiritual malnutrition, losing the art of intimacy, losing the art of community, and losing the art of dialogue. Can't have a democracy without dialogue.
Well, at the moment, we don't have much dialogue, and this takes us directly to the problem.
But we have it on this show. I got to get that in, though, y'all. This is very serious dialogue.
Your word for that, I think, is soul death.
And soul murder.
Soul murder, I'm sorry. Yes. I sort of go the next step.
But that's aggressive.
You don't say that lightly. You are not sort of sloppy with words in my experience. And soul murder is not, I think, a nice thing to do.
Absolutely. In some ways, it's the worst thing.
So how do we get in? How did that happen? Why are we murdering souls? Why would we want to do that?
I think it's because we're worshiping at the golden calf of wealth and power and status.
That's an old story.
It's an old story.
And it's very current.
Very current. And go back to Egypt, but for me, the high moment, of course, is in Hebrew scripture, of worshiping of that golden calf. And, of course, all of us, black, white, Jewish, Catholic, Buddhist, are candidates to worship at that golden calf.
Is that what America's doing now? Is that what you're saying?
I think too, in an excessive way, yes. I think that we're really losing sight of what it is to talk about the caring of a soul, both in the Socratic sense and in the deeply religious sense, because it means you have to both have a deep respect for both self and other, and it also means you have to take time to think, take time to reflect, and take time to care and love. The market-driven society is not about thinking, reflecting, loving. It's about a whole host of other things.
we can talk about the other things
when we come back.
We'll be back in just a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. By all means, be with us.